Welcome to Counter Stories, a podcast by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. I'm Anthony Galloway, a race equity consultant, and I run an arts organization called Arts Us.
Luz Maria Frias, president and CEO of YWCA Minneapolis.
Don Eubanks, associate professor at Metropolitan State University and cultural consultant.
Lee Lee, owner of the Other Media Group.
And I'm Jonathan Blakely, program director of NPR News.
So today we've been sitting around talking and having a kind of a conversation of all the things coming out. And what came to the surface for me running an Afrocentric arts organization is we've been having a lot of conversations about Donald Glover's This Is America. Mm-hmm. And it got us talking about our everyday experiences, not only with racism, but the dissonance we face with every headline that comes through. So today we're going to kind of do a grab bag or potpourri, if you will, of experiences that we have all had as people of color running through our everyday headlines. And most specifically, the dissonance we face where one thing is real at the same time as another thing is real, and we have to struggle and live with all of those realities at the same time. So who wants to jump in and go first?
I'll jump in. What really struck me in the last few days was the worldwide attention to the rescue efforts of the 12 soccer players in Thailand in the cave. And I, like every other person, care about these young lives and wanted them to be rescued and extricated safely. It was sad that we lost a Navy SEAL in that from Thailand in the process. But all eyes were on them and no expenses were spared. And in fact, we had Elon Musk, you know, contributing in terms of high-tech machinery and batteries and the like. The dissonance, however, juxtaposed that scenario with the 5,000, at least, children of Central American descent that are right now stuck in cages of their own, not of their own will, much like the children in Thailand, but were placed there by our U.S. government. And we heard over and over in the storytelling of the 12 soccer players how important it was for reunification with their family. And yet that has been the central defect, if you will, omission in separating our children from Central America from their families. And the lack of immediacy or urgency as well. All hands on deck were there for the 12 boys in Thailand. That does not necessarily apply to the 5,000 children in that have been encaged by our government. And in fact, the government failed the deadline, the first deadline for allowing and releasing and reunifying children 5 years and younger. So imagine you've got 3 and 5 year olds and even younger appearing before an immigration court judge without representation, and somehow they're supposed to maneuver the system. And I also think the sense of urgency isn't there, clearly. And the analogy that I heard actually from a policymaker, I don't remember what state, he said, for most of us, anywhere in the world, if you lose your car keys or your house keys, you're in a panic. Mm-hmm. If you lose your wallet, you're in a panic. What state of mind are you in when you lose your children?
You know, I can speak to that. Well, I can't speak to that because thank God I've not lost my child in any outside setting or anything like that. But when I was my child's age, I would hide in the department store under the clothes rack because why not? And I would see my mother pace back and forth and I'd hear the pages. But I'm a kid and mom went crazy. And absolutely. I know that now as a father. I didn't know it then. But imagine what was going through her mind in the 70s.
Absolutely.
Imagine what's going through these parents'
minds.
Well,
and as U.S., right, we are the bastions of constitutional rights, the bastions of due process.
Were.
Well, that, historically speaking, that's what we've been, we've held ourselves out to be. Yet, in effect, de facto, we have been terminating the parental rights of asylum seekers without due process.
Well,
but,
no
but,
notice.
But lose.
Can I just say, right. even well, no, even seen. At your gym, like your gym, if you go to LA Fitness or what other gyms are there?
YWCA.
YWCA, right? They have the child care area even they're better at keeping information on who the children's parents are than our government. Like, that's just sad. When you go somewhere and you drop your child off like that, you expect them to, here's your phone number, your name, blah, blah, blah. It boggles my mind when somebody takes a one-year-old away and doesn't ask the parents for their information.
Or, you know, or something around the wrist, something. Right. Do something. A tattoo, anything.
Yeah.
But if we examine what you said a little bit deeper in terms of this is the land of constitutional rights, if we step back and look at that, who have benefited from those constitutional rights? And so under this current administration, clearly there's a demarcation line in terms of who those constitutional rights apply to and always have in this country. My Facebook feed for the 4th of July blew up from my Native American relatives and friends, because in the Declaration of Independence, it refers to us as the merciless Indian savages. So even in that comment, in terms of constitutional right, I'm not saying that to give an out to the administration. There is no sense of urgency. These are children of color. How quickly they geared up to separate these kids and the fact that they have not been able to reunite them isn't because they can't. It's because they're not doing it.
Right.
But this right here is the dissonance that we're faced with, right? Because that doesn't compute and make sense.
Right.
And so you're stuck with this consternation within communities of color who aren't seeing this in the ways that within communities of color you hear much more along the lines of what you're describing, Luz, at coffee shops and in tables and in and around dinner tables, is how can this be true and this be true at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. Why did the facts get twisted in this way and we're allowed to be criminalized?
Just one note I was going to add, sorry, is that this is fundamentally a human rights violation. Mm-hmm. I mean, forget anything else in terms of what you believe, you know, how the media has portrayed folks or not. Fundamentally speaking, it's a human rights violation to take a child away from their biological parent without notice, without consent, and against their will.
Even though I don't have kids, it's scary to me to even think that if I had kids, what I would be going through.
And if any other country in the world were doing this, I would bet a fair amount of money that we would be the first to point the other finger at and shame folks and expect something different. And the shame here also is that
this administration.
I beg to differ, because I think, you know, he's one that easily will shame others. But
yeah,
the other part of this is where is the international community in holding us accountable as a nation? So anyway,
I don't think it matters anymore. I mean, there's a balloon of Donald Trump in London, right? We're the butt of a lot of jokes. It hasn't made an impact on us.
But I think it does matter, because we are, the country is being looked at, certainly not the way it was looked at not too many years ago,
right,
you know?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I think our credibility as a country has certainly diminished.
And I've experienced that firsthand. As I came into this Afrocentric organization, one of my jobs is to reach out to folks across the African diaspora. And as I reach out to countries outside of the United States, prior to this administration, those reach outs were much more welcoming. Now I'm having to compete in a way that I didn't have to compete before for attention, for space, for meetings. You know, I was reaching out to the Institute for Democracy in South Africa, where I was able to spend some time working for several months in the 10-year anniversary of the end of apartheid in South Africa. And even while I was there, there was at least let's talk to this guy because there's some networking partners there. Now when I make those calls, it's like, okay, well, we're already working with Germany. We're already working with folks in the part of the diaspora.
Volumes.
So all of a sudden now I'm in a different space. There's like, at one point it was, we want to come to America and have artists come through here and stuff like that. Now I have to get in line.
You've been downgraded.
When I was in Iceland on a layover and I took a bus into Reykjavik, the bus driver was a man from Syria. And he asked us where we were from. We said, you know, Minnesota, America. And he brought up Trump. And then he said, I'm happy I'm here in Iceland. From Syria to Iceland, he came with nothing. He said, he would not want to have come to the U.S. And that says a lot, in that immigrants are no longer seeing the U.S. as the place to go.
Well, it's funny that you mention that, because as we talk about the dissonance that's there, we have U.S. citizens who are not seen as such.
Yeah.
One of the pieces of dissonance that came up for me was the video of the woman in the Puerto Rico shirt that was accosted, or I say accosted. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the legal definition is.
Oh, yeah, she was verbally accosted, yeah.
For being a citizen.
We actually have tape from NPR, newscast tape of that incident.
Let's take a listen.
In Chicago, Cook County officials say they are now investigating a confrontation in which an apparently intoxicated white man harassed a young woman at a park for wearing a shirt with the Puerto Rican flag on it, including why an officer nearby did not immediately stop the harassment when he was asked for help. Mia Irizarry posted a Facebook video of the incident last month. Here's a clip.
You should not be wearing that in the United States of America. Okay. Are you a citizen?
Yes, I am a citizen.
Are you a United States citizen?
Can you please get away from me?
Then you should not be
Can
wearing
you please
that.
Get away
you
from
should
me?
Be wearing the United States
officer,
of America.
Officer, I feel not highly right uncomfortable. Can
Are you
a please
citizen?
Grab him?
The man on the video is identified as 62-year-old Timothy Tribus. The officer reportedly has been assigned to desk duty, while he is also under investigation. A poll last year by Morning Consult found that nearly half of Americans don't know that people born in Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory, are U.S. citizens.
Half. Half of the people in this country
okay.
have
that doesn't
no
surprise
idea.
Me. Even after the hurricane, they still
Right.
Still
I was
going to
say, almost a year after Hurricane Maria, that folks still don't know. But you know what? That's not even an issue.
Yeah.
If she were wearing a t-shirt from Tobago or Liberia, it doesn't matter. Who is he to demand to know if someone other than he who doesn't look white, right? Because if you see the video.
Right. I think he means more looking at her than the shirt.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Question whether or not someone has citizenship. I mean,
who
is
cares?
He?
Why are you asking
me? And that goes to another incident that happened earlier this year where an elderly Asian man was accosted because he had on a camouflage t-shirt, and an American vet didn't believe that he had the right to wear such a shirt.
But what makes this particular incident
the
even
Chicago
more
incident.
Egregious is the fact that there was a police officer
right.
standing right there. This woman clearly
it's
was
going
being
on
assaulted
and on and saying,
by
officer,
this
could
white
you help
gentleman.
Me?
Officer, yeah. can you help yeah. me? And he did nothing. In fact, he stood by the white guy that was assaulting her, verbally assaulting her, and did absolutely nothing to stop him, to ask him to quiet down,
right.
to ask
Take him,
him
away.
To leave. He
anything.
Did nothing. He just stood there for at least 3 to 4 to 5 minutes. And did well, absolutely nothing to help this.
And if
lady.
You watch the video, the white man keeps approaching this
yes.
woman.
Yeah.
And she is distancing herself.
She's trying to get away.
She's trying to get away.
Right, right.
So
right.
it's like, obviously, keeps, this now, man is coming
right,
at her. And
right.
the, you can see the police guy in the back.
Just stood there.
Yeah, so,
and he is drunk.
And
the guy is drunk. But that's not the point.
That's, so you're exactly right, Hilly. Her personal space was violated.
Big time.
Over
Several
and over
times.
Again.
Yeah.
Right? And so you have a woman with this man being he's an aggressor at that point,
yep.
both physically with his body and verbally with, as we heard his words, and that officer looked on like he was watching some play or something.
Yeah,
well,
he
there
did
was
absolutely
no reaction whatsoever.
I mean, what
no
was he
attempt.
Waiting for? Was he waiting for a physical assault?
The thing was also is that she had to say multiple times, "I paid for this shelter. I have the permit for this shelter. I'm supposed to be here." She's trying to justify her existence
right.
in this park
right.
to the policeman so that the policeman will step in,
all while never raising her voice.
Yes,
she kept very calm.
She kept
oh
her cool and her. And her calm, much
her,
like all the other ones that we have watched, where you know you're as a person of color, you have no other option,
right? Right.
Because then you can be seen as the agitator.
It's like when you're stopped
the
by
aggressor.
The cops, you got to be a 2 and 10.
So what
you
is
no
your?
Choice.
You know my reaction, because we're usually bombarded with at least one, if not two, or if not three, of these types of videos per day. Happening throughout the country, because this isn't the only incident.
Mm-mm.
I mean, we have the white gentleman calling the police on a resident in a,
ID
in,
Adam.
In a gated community because he's trying to make her prove that she lives there.
And this speaks to, again, you know, we're talking about the dissonance, the things that don't yes. compute in our daily lives that aren't supposed to be true at the same time, and yet we have to live with them. Not only defending ourselves from our right to be here, right, the dissonance of knowing that you're a citizen and encountering somebody who doesn't clearly know that, alcohol or not, you know, one of the other things that comes up with this in terms of dissonance is – well, this person has on alcohol, or this person was mentally unstable. So, okay, we can keep going ticking down the list. So now the qualification in order to bring this up and surface this as a grievance is you have to be of sound mind and have all these conditions. Tell me all the conditions, and I'll give you a story.
Even though I don't know if we're talking about this, if the cop had intervened and this was, I mean, the fact that the cop literally
did nothing.
And that's another level of dissonance because, you, as you just said, Don, the fact that, okay, we've experienced all this experience of white folks calling cops on people of color, presumed or assumed to be up to no good because of the perception of the caller. Now we finally have an example of that being flipped and nothing was done. So now you're with the dissonance of knowing this other pattern exists and nothing was done
on
my
behalf. And I'm sure all this stuff was happening before cell phone videos, but now the videos are out, and there's two sides that I've heard of this. One side is, don't go out there and be crazy racist to somebody because you're going to get caught on camera and you're going to lose your job and people are going to call you out and call you Permit Patty or ID Adam, okay? And the second one is, I've seen videos where people said, I am a racist. I know I'm a racist. They admit they're racist while they're harassing somebody. It's not even anything they're trying to hide anymore. They're saying, look, you're going to get video of me yelling at you, and that's fine because I know I'm a racist, but you don't have the right to be here.
What is the message, though, that that video sends to us on CNN? And that's what troubles me. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that when I watched that incident with the young woman in the park and with the police officer standing back there doing nothing, which condones the behavior of this drunk white male assaulting this young woman, the message clearly is that as a person of color, any white person can approach you with anything. And it's much like being pulled over by a white police officer. Think about that. The message is that as a person of color, my life means nothing here in this country if I'm confronted by a white person. Doesn't matter if they're a cop. It doesn't matter if they're drunk.
Can I summarize that?
Please.
To serve and protect, only certain people.
Exactly.
Right? Not if you are a person of color or indigenous.
And even if the police aren't there, when they do show up, they never listen to our side of the story. They only reinforce the white folks involved.
That's not always true. Some of these videos have come out and the cops have questioned, right? Okay, do you live here? There's your resident card. Okay, that's fine. I'm sorry we wasted your time, blah, blah, blah. But they get praised by the public for listening to the person of color's story. Hmm. And they're heroes now, right?
Well, they may take a picture with them, take selfies.
Right, right. And so it's like, that's your job.
You know, there was an incident in St. Paul involving Ramsey County Sheriff's Department where there was a young black boy who was playing with a fake gun, or it looked like a fake weapon, right? And it's because of the stories and the sensitivity here that she starts reading what's happening. Right. The train wreck is presenting itself, and she does everything in her power to de-escalate and she's responsible for this kid still being alive. The mother has said it. The officer felt it, you know, and I got a chance to sit down when they were engaged in kind of some reconciliation, and the community came and recognized and said, this is the story we want to get out there. And one of the pieces of dissonance that comes out is you've got all these videos and all these things about with all these bad actors. You also have a whole community of folks who are trying to tell you this is what it looks like done well. And we're also not hearing those. And
no, that's one of the pieces of dissonance. I didn't hear that story at all in St. Paul.
I only knew it because I happened to be at the event where the officer was praised. And this was earlier this year.
Okay.
And so one of the things that's missing in this milieu of dissonance causing events, which this is the most egregious thing, right? This is the stuff that's out in front, overtly, at least to us in our communities, ridiculous. But there's a whole lot of subtle, not quite so ridiculous stuff that still matters just as much never heard.
Mm-hmm. So WCCO, again, I'm talking about this dissonance, all right? So WCCO for the past week has been covering that the story of the shooting of Jesse Blevins in North Minneapolis. But for 2 days in a row, you know how they do the tease and then they do commercial and then come back. They would do the tease on you know, update on the shooting. But they would come back and then they would start the story by the fundraiser, or the state is running new license plates for police officers, for the police association, and that you can donate, buy these plates to the police association. They would run that first, then they would move into the story of Blevins shooting in North Minneapolis involving. Now, just think about that, okay?
You're listening to Counter Stories from NPR News. We're going to take a quick news break, but stay with us. More Counter Stories when we return. Right now, let's get to the latest from the NPR newsroom. Welcome back to Counter Stories, and the conversation continues with Halle Lee.
So the City Pages wrote a headline that said, "Finally, a Black Minnesota resident's death worthy of outrage." The guy who wrote this, Mike Mullen, purposely wrote this headline to
be provocative.
To be provocative, to get people to think, because,
But what's interesting about that is, so one of the tools, and there's a lot of research that talks about this, that communities of color use faced with all this dissonance is being able to put forward irony. So you can make an ironic statement and it resonates everywhere around. Yes. You don't have to go through and relive all the stuff. What I encountered when that headline came out, because I was trying to figure out what headline you were talking about at first. So this actually came up in a conversation in equity training where we were having a conversation and there was a group of white folks who thought that that article was very unfair. They completely missed the irony. The dissonance that it caused, however, now is the subtle ask of that group of folks was for the folks of color in there to explain why it was okay for that article to come in there. And the arms crossed and the shoulders shifted and the necks rolled a little bit. And they're just like waiting, like, ha, gotcha. How are you going to explain that, folks of color? So even in a space where irony is finally call out something from the perspective of white folks who are trying to get into the conversation.
There was a lot of outrage over the headline because from white people. And the author said, "I was being provocative." And white people were like, "We didn't like it. It made us feel uncomfortable. And we're going to stop reading City Pages and blah, blah, blah."
And the dissonance-causing piece of that is the responsibility is often placed back on folks of color to make their white peers comfortable when these ironic issues come up and are brought up. And that in itself is another dissonance-causing piece that, again, now folks of color have to do more work.
Dual dissonance going back and forth. Like, I can't. The dissonance won't stop.
It's exhausting.
It is.
Exhausting dissonance.
You know, I just bring this up. So as you were talking about the dissonance that's caused with the policing of people of color and the gatherings of folks of color, there's a Gullah song called Ragga Levy, and in there there's a line called Mississippi. It's a Gullah word for
any
white
male. You might have to explain Gullah for some.
Gullah is, again, now in a space of folks of color having to explain what this, what this is.
People are listening.
So Gullah peoples live in the Jersey Islands and Carolina. Is they were a group of folks who were able to retain much more of their culture because a lot of the forced labor through chattel slavery was done on the islands, and then the overseers would leave to come back to the mainland, allowing those cultures to thrive and retain much more of their African languages and cultures. And so we end up with this pidgin language of Gullah, which is a mixture of a bunch of different languages together. So in that language, now that the description's out there, there's a song called Ragga Levy. And in there, there's a reference to something called Mississippi. And Mississippi was a code name for any white male. So white folks couldn't understand that the slaves were talking about. A lot of slave calls were in field songs were a ways to talk about massive. I talk about the old dumb mule on the plantation. I'm talking about you to your face, but you don't know because you just think I'm an unknowing, less than human, singing happy slave that doesn't know any better. And so it was a way to cope with the dissonance and the issue, you know, of
I'm not laughing about the issue. It just reminded me of another racist thing that happened.
Okay. So I'm going to go right there in a second. But the only reason I bring that up is because Mississippi, as we were telling the story to youth, they immediately said, "Oh, Mississippi." The youth in the program are now referring to officers in their experiences as Mississippi because they were able to see the connection between the story
immediately
and the song and their experiences
with
officers just playing on playgrounds.
Right.
So you know, just I love that we're having this conversation, raising all these dissonance points so that this is the kind of stuff that comes up day to day and folks have to make sense of it and cope with it and deal with it. And there's a lot of different ways that that comes up.
I think a key in what you've said is cope and deal with it, which is a lot easier said than done.
Absolutely. Ask our bodies.
The coping part of it, when you, one of the analogies I read about and visually saw in a short video a few years ago was mosquito bites. Like if your average person, if you have one bite or two bites, you're fine. But if your body is covered with mosquito bites, you are losing your mind because you're itching and they're uncomfortable. Those are those aggressions and points of trauma that average, you know, on average, people of color, indigenous people are facing every single day when you're being bombarded with not only your lived experiences for your loved ones, but then lived experiences for community by way of newspapers or social media. And it can be overwhelming.
The American Indian community is still recuperating from the separation of our children.
That is still going on.
That is still going on.
Speaking of separation of children.
We've had, you know, leaders from Black Lives Matter commit suicide as a result of that as well. I mean, these are very deep wounds that don't have the opportunity to heal when we are bombarded by all of these examples of systemic racism.
I'm just like, I'm tired, you guys. I'm tired. I am. It's exhausting to, I mean, you know, in the Hmong community, I've spent the last couple of days trying to talk to Hmong people about we shouldn't hate Black people. You know, we shouldn't be on that side. Because you watch the news and you see that a Black guy did this and a Black guy did this and a Black woman did this. And so it's becoming a stereotype. Or the immigration issue. A lot of Hmong people didn't care about it until now when they're saying, hey, we're going to come for the Hmong people next. Right? Then all of a sudden we care. And I'm just tired.
And you know what's interesting about that is when you look at race equity issues and you look at the experience of racism, and I don't say systemic racism because racism is systemic, so I feel like it's a redundant statement. But
we have to keep repeating that because the trainings I've done and research that supports it is folks of color refer to racism as systemic racism. I mean, you don't have to say it out loud, but we have to pivot that against the common understanding by dominant society, white folks who believe racism is one-on-one.
Absolutely.
And not, being a racist.
And not systemic racism.
But we're folks of color sitting around a circle, so I'm not going to waste that energy because I don't want to get tired like Lee's talking about. But the piece that comes to mind in that is that even when in between intra and interracial racism that happens in that space still reproduces an outcome that puts white at the top and Black at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so it gets real uncomfortable for many folks as we talk about this to say, aha, there's people of color being racist against another person. And, you know, there's that asterisk there that says, okay, yeah, but the net result of Black and Hmong conflict isn't the superiority of Hmong folks over Black folks or the superiority of Black folks over Hmong folks. Data-wise, the only thing that happens is we continue to have poor outcomes compared to our white peers.
Right.
And so the net outcome continues to still uphold a system, all the way created by Carolus Linnaeus and Blumenbach and all those folks with white at the top and Black at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that fatigue is real. And I see kids come into our center specifically with that fatigue. Like, I just want to drown. I want to do art form that fills me up because everything else is draining my tank.
Mm-hmm.
So then what do we do about that?
You know, every morning you're like, what did the mental patient do today? And I'm just like, I want to wake up one morning and be like impressed. Be like, this administration did something really awesome and good for human rights. And I just want to smile. But it hasn't happened yet. And I'm tired.
It makes me think of the resiliency in our communities. The fact that our people, and when I say our people, African Americans, Native Americans, Hispanic, Latino, Mexican, all people of color that are in this country, indigenous or not, we have withstood this our entire lives. And our ancestors, right? I mean, I always jokingly, you know, when confronted by a white person about who I am or where I'm from, you know, I always jokingly would say, well, my ancestors were here to greet you with a six-pack and a sandwich, but you guys never left. And but from that first contact forward, you know, we've had to deal with this day in and day out. But the resiliency of our people to withstand this, even, I mean, there have been times in the past 2-3 weeks where, you know, I feel so overcome by sadness that I have a hard time understanding why my white neighbors dislike us so much. Not all of them, right? But quite a few of them. I just can't wrap my mind around that. Why there's this hatred for people of color, other than the system that has fed them this lie their entire life, convincing them that they're better than us.
I've asked myself that question. So I meditate every day a couple times a day, and in the evening even longer. And you learn so much through meditation about yourself, and you question things about yourself, but others as well. And when you start with the question, who am I, right? And what role do you play in this world? And you get into the metaphysical in terms of the universe and what the universe then has in store for all of us. And you, and the place that I am struggling with is the amount of hatred, and that's in the universe and the world, because it's not just the U.S. Because we see the bashing of, you know, the Syrians and all over the world,
all over Europe.
Yeah. And that's the part that I have a hard time reconciling. And what I come to often is this place of scarcity, right? That if someone gets something that you believe they shouldn't, that there is less for you to have then, right? Whether it be basic necessities, right, in terms of food or housing or wealth, and even human rights. I mean, human rights are fundamentally basic. If you have a human right, Anthony, that doesn't mean I don't have human rights. That doesn't make my human rights less. But we're in a time when the feeling of scarcity and having that be the baseline where people then resort to fear of losing what they have, whatever amount it is they have, and the hate that this is all me trying to wrap my mind around. You know, I don't know that to be true, but I'm trying to wrap up this dissonance. You
know,
yeah.
But in our culture, you know, because I think we all sit around and have these thoughts. And again, I think a lot of that is based on the culture that was created by Europeans.
And colonizers.
Exactly. Whatever you want to call them. But it's the culture they created where money, where resources, where those kind of things became important. When I think about my culture as American Indian, for us it was your wealth was really gauged by what you didn't have because you gave it away to others. It wasn't about what you collected, what you had. So as I was listening to you describe that, it's because we are a part of this culture that Europeans created, white Europeans created.
And so, you know, as you wrestle, as we talk about wrestling with these places of dissonance, it does make me beg the question then, so what are the things, you know, as we cope with this, because we know we can take it, and we've had hundreds of years of doing so with really egregious things, right? You know, and as I think about even now, even the things that we cry rivers over now, right? Most folks don't understand that the Trail of Tears itself was called the Trail of Tears because of white settlers and slaves who lined to see how ridiculous the condition was for the Cherokee, who would refuse to cry themselves, to keep and hold and show themselves resilient, to carry their dead and bury them in the land of the that they were now being forced to move to. And even all that outcry didn't change the fact that the removal still happened, right? So we're often presented with these things of just surviving. However, when I'm in community, there is much more than survival that's present. And so as I think about coping with the dissonance, the first place I think of is being in a circle of And I get to say this now. This is why I'm so happy just where I am, because I have something to let loose as an outlet. But to be sitting in a drum circle.
Just going
to
say a drum circle, exactly.
Who know about the diaspora and know the different connections and come from different pieces of the diaspora, whether newly arrived, multiple generations, East, West, North, South Africa, whatever it is, learning the languages of these things, learning African kings and queens, learning all these pieces about self outside of just mere survival. I've watched these students from the beginning of our interaction with them to now go from a place of constantly talking about the coping to now talking about not just the resilience, but who I am outside of that.
The strength.
Yeah. And there's this buffer that is forming. So when we talk about, I'm really interested to know, what are some of the things that you do around this circle to cope with this?
Well, I was just going to say a drum circle. I mean, the only... Just trying to think about this before I say it, but I can't describe the feeling I felt when I'm in a room of people playing a djembe and the dunduns and everything. When we're all playing in unison, everything that we're talking about now, it's gone.
The whole community is represented there. Right. Everybody's working together.
Literally, there's a whole nother spirit going on.
And we're not talking about the co-opted drum circle experience where everybody's just willy-nilly just beating on stuff like that.
No, no, no. This is when you know
actual rhythms.
These are rhythms.
Actual talent, actual technique.
No, seriously. These are rhythms that go back centuries. That the same rhythm that's been going back to Guinea. Right.
I just want to make sure that distinction is clear to folks listening.
This isn't played in the hallway.
We really needed to have a video shot of that.
This is real. No,
the real deal.
When you learn these rhythms and how the rhythms got here, and the fact that these rhythms have been passed down from generation to generation, and it's the same rhythm.
Playing lamba, mandingo, kosi.
And then when you start going there, and you got, whether you got 3 people, you got 20 people welling up. Mm. Oh my gosh, there's no other feeling that I can describe like that. None. And then we stop, and then it's back to work.
But it allows you to put a buffer up to cope, to get some time where you don't have to, where you get to put some energy back in the tank. Lee, you're making a face like you may not have that space.
I put a djembe in front of you, trust me.
My buffer, I drink. No. I'm just, and I hate this about myself, but like when you're talking, Anthony, about these kids that you're working with, in my mind I'm thinking that's only 20 kids. In this world, though.
But who those 20 kids touch?
I understand. So I wish that I didn't have that thinking where I just want everyone to know and to understand. And that's the way my mind is. And so as great as that is, I'm like, there are like thousands and thousands of us. And maybe it's the white people who need to learn this. And, you know, there's this hour something. I really needed my loose fix today. I was just feeling down about everybody and everything.
I'll give you some love, girl.
I mean, that's, I was going to say earlier to what Don was saying. There, we are very resilient, but there is a lot of pain, and the scars are deep. When we were talking about Thai, the situation in Thailand, first thing that went to my mind is Katrina, and all the efforts that went into what we saw in Thailand. Thank God the kids are all right. But what didn't happen
for Katrina,
and I'm still scarred by that, even though I was in D.C. when it happened. I'm watching on TV. I don't know anyone down there, but I am still scarred from what I saw.
Yes, and what's still not happening in Puerto Rico.
Exactly.
I mean, we have yet, we're 10 months into post the hurricane in Puerto Rico.
We're in a new hurricane season already.
Right. And still, there are thousands of people without.
How is that a thing?
Electricity. And that the government pulled out and said, you know, we're done. We're pretty much, you're no longer a priority. And the exploitation that has occurred on the island of other interests coming in and buying just large parcels of land to then develop it into some resort, you know, at a future date, at the expense of the people, because they had to abandon their properties, you know, default on them, right? Because out of necessity.
You know, we're talking about this dissonance conversation. There is a conversation that's happening that I've seen on social media where people of color are saying, hey, white people, don't get mad that we're coming to this country, because a lot of times it's things your country did to our country that's forcing us to flee. And it's just the secret war for the Hmong people. That's why it was a secret, because they didn't want people to know the sorts of horrible things that they were having children do. And And then, you know, you get this thing like, why are you in our country? Why are you here? And it's like, well, I'm here because I had to flee my country because y'all ditch us. You well, know, but no one knows about that. And that's exactly what you're talking to Don about, you know, this culture that was built by these Europeans. It still exists today in the things that our government and the people in power do.
You see, now you're touching on the educational piece, which mm-hmm. I tend to bring up every once in a while. Here in this country, in terms of what we're taught and what we're not
yes.
taught.
Yes.
And it's what this country elects not to cover. What was that stat that was used? 50% of Americans don't know
Puerto Rican is
part of the United States. And even though they don't have official statehood, you know,
They're Americans.
Just like Guam, just they're like
citizens.
Filipinos.
Yeah, they're citizens.
Exactly.
They vote for the president.
When I was state director for Minnesota for the single state authority on alcohol and drugs, and we would meet nationally, there would be representatives from Guam, from the Virgin Islands, from Puerto Rico, who all have a say at the table. They're part of this country. These are other islands that the United States have colonized. But they're part of this group. And the fact that 50% of Americans don't know that, and that doesn't surprise me. You know, it's like me asking my students, how many reservations are there in the state of Minnesota?
No, it surprised me because I thought maybe after the hurricane and everything that happened that it would be more than 50% at least would know.
Well, our friend in Chicago didn't know.
Well, right. Because that 50% exactly. thinks it's fake news. And that, I'm sure that seems to be the mantra that comes from that other side, is anything that challenges their beliefs has got to be fake. It's fake news. It can't be real if it's going to challenge what they're being told.
Or what they want to believe.
Exactly.
It may be a combination of what they're being told, you know, if they're watching a certain network news that's three letters.
Starts with F.
You know, rhymes with socks. But it's what they want to believe. And there's actually a lot of research on this, that people can be presented with facts and still not take in the facts and accept them because they want to hold true to their own beliefs. So you get another dissonance, right? Not being able to reconcile that when folks are so set in their ways and that's also privilege. This, like I have folks will have the privilege of holding on to their own beliefs and refusing to accept the facts. And in the field of law, you know, it's often said, you can have your own version of the story, but you can't have your own version of the facts. Yep. The facts remain to be, you know.
What my husband and I picked up is we'll say, I personally don't believe it. And that came from a saying from an interview of a woman who lost her health care. She got on Obamacare, but it's called the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. So she said, no, I'm not on Obamacare. I'm on the Affordable Care Act. Okay. And the reporter produced her with the information, and she said to the reporter, well, I personally don't believe it. Okay. And that is, it's so true. And we see that all the time in this country, and I'm sure around the world, but the facts were in front of her, and she personally didn't believe it. So she walked away, still believing she wasn't on Obamacare.
Exactly.
I just find it very interesting as I sit back and I listen to where our conversation goes after the prompt of what do you do to deal with your dissonance? And one of the things that came out is the thing that we as people of color do to deal with dissonance. We put it on the table. We face it. Because moving yourself away from it is no fix. And we've learned that over time.
And still we rise.
This Sunday we're going to see probably some of the ultimate dissonance, because many of the players for the French World Cup team are of either African or Arab descent.
And yet dissonance
keeps
moving forward.
So there's the blue for you.
I want to thank you for this conversation because it has been a little bit cathartic for me. But you bring up something very interesting, Luz, and that is a quote by James Baldwin. I always like to quote James Baldwin, who was a master of dealing with dissonance as a gay black male whose job it was to write in the space and tell the story of that part of the civil rights movement.
During the 50s and
during the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. right?
Brilliant mind.
Mm-hmm. And as you talk about, you know, the fake news and the and all that kind of things, I'm reminded of this quote by James Baldwin. That, and James Baldwin says, I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense that once the hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with the pain. Mm-hmm. I thank you for dealing with the pain for us. Today is another episode of Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway.
Luz Maria Frias.
Don Eubanks.
Lily.
Jonathan Blakely.
We'll see you next time.
Slipping up, don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Don't catch you slipping up. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is Gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, yeah, I'm so cold, like, yeah. I'm so dull, like, yeah.